Rent, of course, is the other way in which they go out money off you. High inflated rents, of course, was a great problem during Marx's time. You know, the landlords would literally rip off the workers on the basis of take it or leave it. And of course, in the 1920s, we had Rackmanism and all that sort of stuff, you know, which was supposed to have been controlled, but anyone who tried to get a flat or something like that will still know that landlords seem to have it as a code. They've got to rip people off, particularly the most vulnerable, for the maximum amount of money possible. And to this must be added the de facto rent of mortgages, where again workers are forced in order to seemingly buy their own home, you know, to take out mortgages, which saddle them debts, which last all, you know, in effect their whole lives. So rent, interest and profit represents an additional way in which the ruling class grabs as much surplus value from the working class's hands as possible. And it's a struggle for surplus value, which is at the heart of class conflict, after all, because if it didn't, then why would you have strikes and political upheavals and labour movements being formed and stuff like that, other than for the fact that there are two classes within society, a capitalist class and a proletariat, whose interests are diametrically opposed. The aim of the working class should be to get the fruits of their labour, which has been denied to them by a capitalist class who is actually increasing, taking more and more money away from them and pushing them down. You know, one of the things which Marx talks about is the immiserization of the working class. And people always attack Marx on this, saying, what are you talking about? Workers today compared to the 19th century, they're all going around in rags and selling their babies and stuff like that. Now they've all got microwaves and cars. But if you actually read what Marx says, well, first we were talking about the bottom layer of society. We talked about pauperism. You know, and I think it's fair to say, if you look at the absolute bottom layers of society, that their living conditions are probably worse than what they were under, in the 19th century. But in any case, the question of the relationship between the ruling class and the working class is a relative thing. And I think the statistics we produced over the last few years have proved that the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer in relative terms. There's equations we produced, the Gini formula and stuff like that, which calculates how much wealth is in the hands of the fewest people, how much is in the hands of the largest group of people, and those statistic figures are getting higher and higher, you know, in terms of how much the richest 5% have and how much the poorest 80 or 90% have, you know, in terms of in real terms, if you like, in that sense. So this exploitation, if you like, is at the heart of Marxist economics. Now, how does... I won't deal too much with this, I've really got them running out of time to a certain extent. How does a capitalist work out its production costs? Well, it divides it up to a certain extent. First of all, it looks at the cost of raw materials, which is an obvious cost to start with. You know, when we print a journal, we buy inks, we buy paper, we buy plates. Then there's the, not the actual cost of the machinery, but rather its depreciation. In other words, how much is lost? Because otherwise, actually, it would be a fixed cost, which would disappear from all equations. We'd all be using 19th century machines, and indeed, the printing press downstairs probably was a 19th century machine. But you know, but you'd only have to buy one building, a factory once, and a machine once, and it would last forever. But of course, machines don't work like that. Buildings don't work like that. They wear out. They have to be replaced after a period of time. They're new printing press, new. Collator machine, rather, if you've got, will wear out. It won't last 100 years at some point. And capitalists work out this cost as a cost of depreciation. In other words, work out how long it will last, how much it costs them to buy it, and they divide it up. So they say, okay, in any given year, our machinery will lose £1 million of value, because at the end of 10 years we'll have to buy £10 million worth of machinery. Whatever the equation is, they're quite adept at working this out. And that's added to their cost. These are fixed costs, if you like, which Marx is constant capital, if you like, he uses that phrase. Then is the other cost, which is the labour cost, which adds value, but it's variable. And Marx therefore calls it variable capital. And the aim is to try and decrease this cost and increase the amount of value which it which it produces. That is why capitalism spends all its time trying to make workers work harder, longer, giving them machinery which will make them more productive, i.e. you can employ less workers to produce the same amount of goods, or if there's a demand, produce more goods, whatever. In other words, increase the productivity of labour, the profitability of labour as far as they're concerned. So at the end of the day, when the capitalist works out what the value of the item is, at the end, which they put in their market with the usual markup and the rest of it, they split it up. Constant capital, variable capital, and then there's the third factor, which is the money they've nicked, which is the surplus value, which they then add to the value. Of course, they've only spent on the first two items, the constant capital and the variable capital. The surplus value is their markup, their wedge, their wad, if you like, you know, the wetting of the beak, all the phrases which you use, which represents their profit, which they then hoard in terms of capital. And that is what capitalism does. It's very adept at doing it. It hoards vast amounts of money for its own personal use and for its for its greater glory, if you like. There are 1,001 variations which follow on from this, and which Marx spent a lot of time analysing. For example, there's certain things like the fetishization of goods, which sounds a bit kinky, to be honest. It's probably not the word we might want to use, but which is that some goods seem to assume a mystic quality all of their own, which is quite, you know, which has nothing to do with the cost of production, the cost of labour, anything, but which is pushed up on and given a value, a price also, which has nothing to do at all with their how much it costs, with anything I've just mentioned, but which is part of the bizarre quirks of capitalism. And also, and the obvious example which Marx spent a lot of time thinking about is art, where goods are given an arbitrary price, quite irrespective of how much it costs. So a Van Gogh painting will cost $30 million. Now, poor Van Gogh didn't get $30 million, he didn't get $3. You know, all he got was a doctor to have his ear sewn back on, you know. But capitalism, arbitrarily, if you like, given these goods a value, so they can, you know, a mystic value, if you like. Of course, this can go up and down. The other example comes before Rembrandt. Now, there's been wads of Rembrandt paintings around. And then, about 20, 30 years ago, a load of art historians examined all of Rembrandt's paintings and determined about half of them were actually not painted by Rembrandt at all, but by a school of Rembrandt or put away assistants. This meant that the paintings, which didn't materially change from one day to the next, lost a considerable amount of money. You know, the National Gallery had a load of Rembrandts that used to show, and they now store away because they're not Rembrandt, a school of Rembrandt. They think they're not worth looking at. The paintings themselves have not changed, but the fetish nature of capitalism gives to them has changed. Therefore, they perceive that the value has dropped. This perception is all important, because if people suddenly decided that Van Gogh was a total waste who couldn't paint to save his life, and his works are not great art at all, then the value would disappear from these paintings, although they themselves would materially be the same. So you've got all these sort of variations and quirks, which are all there for capitalism to try and make money and hold money. Because when firms buy paintings, they're not buying it because our companies, all the people sitting in Canary Wharf over there, are filled with people who have a fine understanding of art and believe it's their role in life, and they go into their office each day, look up a painting for £30 million and just sit and gaze at it. Now, they walk straight by it. As far as they're concerned, it means nothing. It's just paint on a thing, but it's got this value of £30 million, and it's like banknotes or bonds or checks or anything else like that. It's a way of storing money now, because this is it's a lot more complicated than that, and I haven't really got time to go into that, so I'm going to stop there as far as that's concerned. What I really wanted to deal with was the essential core of what Marxist economics is about, because it's not accepted by bourgeois economists, it's argued against, but Marx wanted people to understand this. When capital was produced, he'd already produced the boring stuff, earlier than that, the dry books in economics, he intended this book, and that's why it took him 20 years longer than it's supposed to have done, you know, way late on his, and only produced one volume. We talked about six, as I mentioned earlier. Only one was produced in his lifetime, two thereafter by Engels, and subsequent to that, the Theories of Surplus Value, and then they dug up Grundrisse and all manner of other tomes follow on from it. The reason he wanted to do it, he wanted his work to be understood as a political work which would expose the brutal and callous nature of capitalism. The style of, and I know it's difficult because it's 150 years old nearly now, and to be honest, all books which are that age are not easy to read. I mean, I don't think many people pop home and say, oh, I think I'll read a bit of Dickens. You know, Dickens was the most popular author in Britain. Very few people actually read him for entertainment. You know, and any more than any of the other great novels of the late 18th or 19th or even early 20th century, you know, all the Silas Marners, all them Jude Obscures, all them other books, you know, people who have in their libraries are in the main unread because it's difficult to read. And these are novels, not anything else, you know, and certainly therefore a book which is about politics, about economy, written 150 odd years ago, translated from German, is not going to be easy. But Marx did hope the book would be read, not by the people who actually would have found it easiest to read, the ruling class and the bourgeois, but by workers, because his book actually is a passionate expose of how capitalism works. You know, and he it's interesting. I didn't realise it recently. Yet. One of Marx's favourite books was Frankenstein, and he loved all those sort of books. You know, if he lived a bit longer, he could have read Dracula. But unfortunately, you know, he didn't, and he would have loved that book. Because the Capital is full of allusions to capitalism as a monster, as a vampire, literally sucking the blood from the working class. And he uses that analogy time and again, because he's actually quite angry about what's exposed. Marx was one of the first people, and also Engels in the condition of the working class, to use the tendency which the ruling class had to document their brutality and take these documents out and reveal them, as he hoped, to the labour movement and to the working class. So Capital is full of official reports, factory inspectors and reports, government reports, parliamentary debates, articles in the Financial Times and the London Times and the rest of it, exposing what capitalism does. Often, you know, often almost what we call lurid details, you know, examples of people starving to death in factories and stuff like that. Because he wanted people to see what capitalism was like and how it operated. It wasn't operated by visionary entrepreneurs, which, to be honest, was how capitalism was presenting itself in the 19th century, full of people who wore huge top hats and coats and were being incredibly creative, you know, as they put it themselves. Marx said, no, these people are sitting there grabbing money from the workers which they employ on appalling rates and conditions, working long hours, day after day after day, and making those conditions increasingly worse. One of the things that Marx talks about, and again we can discuss this, is intensification of labour. And it's certainly something which has become far more noticeable in the 20th century than the 19th century. If you go back to the 17th century, you'd probably be quite shocked at the number of hours people worked. You know, they seem to work very long hours, you know, compared to what we work, although that's changing now. Capitalism is getting us back to the 17th century. You know, people would work 11, 12 hours a day, and they're the privileged people. You know, any worker had that, they'll be swanning it. Oh, I'm a privileged worker. Why weren't they all dying of exhaustion rather than dying of all the other things that people died of in the 17th century? Well, of course, the pace of life was a lot slower. The intensification of labour was a lot less. Well, it was now, you know, people had more holidays, more rest. The actual physical amount of work they had to do was a lot less vigorous, in one sense, pressurised, than it is now. You know, although there were times when you had to work very long hours, there were also times when you didn't work at all, particularly in seasonal things. And of course, in the 19th century, we saw, for example, the way which capitalism started to change farm life, which was a big issue, as a matter of fact, during that time, and the bringing in of threshing machines and stuff like that, which increased the workload on the farm workers and also decreased the number of farm workers who were required. So you've got large numbers of farm workers being left without jobs, which they'd had, you know, they and their ancestors they had for centuries. And of course, many of them were impoverished, they became angry, got the Captain Swing movement, where farms and haystacks had been burnt. And large numbers, of course, ended up being pushed into the cities, you know, because they had no other place to go, and that's where the work was. And they were pushed into the factories and the appalling, horrific conditions which they then found themselves. It must have been a nightmare, and it's just nightmare which Marx reflects in Capital. And that is why it's so important. Now, we don't analyse economics simply as a scientific question, although as scientific socialists, we obviously approach all things from a clear method, an actual method, organised method. But also we approach it with a sense of the passion which Marx brought to all his writings, which is why he worked himself literally into a grave. You know, he could see what's wrong with society, but then he memorably said, the point is not to not to see, like the paraphrase, the point is not to understand what is happening, but to change it. And that is why Marx wasn't just a great economist, a great philosopher, a great historian, and he's a man who could turn his hand to anything. He's the sort of guy that learned algebraic simply because he felt he better do, you know, just to make a few things clear. Or picked up relearned Russian just so he could read a few books in Russian which he couldn't otherwise get hold of. You know, he's an incredibly gifted man. But this is a guy who was also active in the labour movement, who co-wrote the Communist Manifesto, formed the First International, and all the other things, you know, tried to establish a revolutionary party, a party of the working class worldwide, able to bring to an end the horror which he documents in Das Kapital and in many other writings, you know, particularly his journalistic writings, and bring about an end to this, by enabling the one class who could bring an end to it, the working class, to come to power. Because, as Marx explained many times, capitalism needs the working class to create its wealth, to create its surplus values it steals from them. But it also notes that the working class are the grave diggers of capitalism. They are the one class, because they are organised, because they work in a uniform fashion, in groups, not as individuals, they are the one class capable of creating the political structures and the ideas which will overthrow them. And that remains the case now more than ever. So I'll leave it there.
Thanks. Okay.